Welcome back to another episode of the Huxley Morton podcast, the show where each week we speak to pharma company owners and industry leaders sharing their stories of personal and professional growth. We're now on series four of the show, and as you may already be aware, we're on a mission to help clinical researchers from around the world with tips, tricks, and inspiration. So if you could do me a quick favor and please hit that follow or subscribe button, it really does help more than you'll ever know. Once again, Adam Walker is alongside me, so sit back, relax, and we'll take things from here. This week, Adam and I are joined by Dr. Fox, Dr. Daniel Fox, that is, founder and CEO at Clinical Research Payment Network. Now, Daniel, I know that you're involved in quite a few things, but to give us a bit of an intro, what's, you know, Clinical Research Payment Network, what does this revolve around? I know plenty of our audience would have perhaps seen you active, but in your own words, how would you describe things?
Hi, James. How are you? It's nice to meet you, and thank you for having me on. I think in a nutshell, Clinical Research Payment Network is my attempt as a seasoned professional in industry. So I've been over in the development side, I've been in the manufacturing side, and here I am in the clinical site side to try to align the expectations of what I know the sponsors want versus what is actually happening on the clinical site level. Specifically, with a lot of experience in contracts and patents and in the development of the drug, it's kind of surprising and even concerning to see all of the standards that are pretty much dropped as soon as trials hit the clinical sites. So that's essentially what I'm here to try to advocate for is payments to sites in a way that can help to translate the research in a much more efficient way.
Okay, cool. Well, look, I know that you talk about this regularly online, but for those that have not come across you, I feel like we're diving straight into the deep end here, but what are the typical kind of problems that sites have on the payment front? Because I think it'll probably, you know, and where did this, you know, kind of mission of yours come from? Because this will perhaps give us a bit of a backstory to you and where the business come from. So what are the typical frustrations? Is probably how to sum it up, right?
Well, there's actually two questions in there. And so I'll start with a small backstory. So as a translational scientist, I started in academia. I moved into small biotech, even in, you know, the biotechs that start in a garage. And then I moved even to California, where I did global pharma manufacturing. In California, I had the diagnosis that changed my life. It was my daughter's terminal diagnosis. And so as a result of that, we ended up coming right back to where we started. And I started working at the clinical site. My daughter died on Christmas Day before COVID. And so as a result, looking here at the clinical site level, it is absolutely infuriating from a widowed father, a grieving father, to see the waste and to see the translation that's not happening in clinical research. So there's the backstory. Part of the motivation is I'm a very angry father who wishes that this technology could be progressing faster for the people out there who are losing their children day after day while we're bickering over metal and paper. So that's kind of the motivation. Now, back to the frustrations is it's strictly contractual and it's primarily about promises. So the contracts have promises and provisions in there for sites, and for some reason, these contracts are ripped up in front of our faces. So the big elephant in the room is payments, right? So payments on time and in a timely fashion. It's no surprise that the average payment on a net 30 contractual term, at least for my site and for a lot of the sites I've been talking to, is well over 100 days. Wow. So more than triple the amount of time it takes to receive the payments that we need to do the research to help our sponsors. Okay. So, yeah.
Look, you've got me kind of a little bit taken back here. Just, you know, I guess the news with your daughter. So that was kind of 2 years back.
So it would have been the December right before COVID hit. So it's December 2019.
Right. So you were working in the research field at that time. And obviously had devastated news. And was it at that point that the business came about? What, you know, what were you doing at that precise time and on the work front? Because look, I get kind of that sort of news is just, yeah, devastating. I can't even, you know, begin to imagine what it was like. You know, how did you deal with that?
Well, as a father, what I ended up doing was I focused on my work. And keep in mind, we knew my daughter was terminal for years. When we were in California, we knew that she was terminal. So I always had this drive and this frustration ever since I started clinical research about this. About that time when I started focusing on my work, I started actually collecting metrics, understanding, documenting, being a scientist, trying to justify everything that we were going through. And through a series of escalations, I actually ran into SCRS, so the Society for Clinical Research Sites. Mm-hmm. At SCRS, I started to realize that my problems weren't solely at my clinic, but they were throughout the globe. It's actually an industry problem. Mm-hmm. And then just over the past year, of course, LinkedIn has just been booming for a lot of people, and I'm one of them. So I started connecting with Brad Hightower, a lot of the other advocates for clinical sites, and then I started standing up and speaking for myself as an advocate. Mm. So there's the drive, the motivation to create the business, but the business itself actually created as a result of trying to invent our own physician compensation models at my site. Mm-hmm. A lot of that had to do with talking with our CEO and trying to explain them exactly how I'm going to pay our physicians based off of the research models that we have, the fixed contracts. Mm. You know, we're going to take this research contract, we're going to do this, we're going to apply this metric, and we're going to do all this. And the CEO just said, stop, we can't do this. We are healthcare. So healthcare is worth trillions of dollars. The mm-hmm. clinical research realm is worth in 2021, $46 billion. So to have clinical research come up to healthcare and expect them to change their models is just not appropriate. Most of the time, the little guy conforms to the big guy. Mm-hmm. And that's where we started our journey, is with the frustrations of me personally and professionally, and then talking with an actual healthcare advocate, realizing that we as clinical research do not adhere to the models of healthcare for financial purposes.
Right, you're gonna have to dial in on this a little bit more so that I can get this, because so healthcare clinical research, I mean, to me, you know, I almost see this as one and the same. So I guess, look, there may be others who are as ignorant as me out there. could you kind of fill in the gap there? Because when I think, you know, clinical research sites, you're going to get, I class that as healthcare. So what is the main differentiator here? Where did this wedge get driven in? Because it sounds like there's clearly a bit of a divide, and I just didn't even expect there to be any difference.
So the biggest example I can say is during one of my negotiations, when someone pulled the token fair market value card, when we're talking about negotiations, that's not fair market value. And it went back and forth a couple times. And finally I said, well, fine, I will give you fair market value. I will take the budget that you gave me, I'll give it to my finance department, and we will charge you the same as we would an uninsured patient. Mm-hmm. And if it's good enough for an uninsured patient, it'd be good enough for the sponsor, it'd be good enough for your trial. And they got that budget immediately and came back and said, whoa, no, we'll accept the first offer that you gave us. That's fine. And so during that conversation, there was a realization where, according to a healthcare facility, sponsor walking into my door is equivalent to that of an uninsured patient. They come in, they ask for services, we negotiate a rate that's never really fully funded. Yeah. And so then as a result, we perform the trials. Mm-hmm. So then I started thinking, what would happen if we actually offered our sponsors an opportunity to have third-party payer systems similar to that of patients with insurance cards? That would be the equivalent of trying to convert this fixed contract, guaranteed to be underfunded, solid agreement into the fluidity of healthcare. So for one, healthcare, if you look at it in the world of a patient, if you go in and you seek services. You get your services, you get a bill on the back end. You don't necessarily have a say in what that cost is, right? You come in, you get the services, you pay. That's even legally, you are required and you are responsible for the payment of the services that you've requested. It's, and so there's your difference, right? So in clinical research, what we do is we create this weird fixed contract model where a sponsor comes in. This is the budget that you will get for the next 5 years. And, you know, this is the set. You know, you're going to get paid this and you have to provide these services.
Right.
That's not healthcare, right? You look like you have a question.
I do. I mean, there's a few questions here, really. The first is, how can any sponsor expect you to work on a fixed price for something that you don't know 100% what you're going to be providing until you've provided it? I don't understand that. You know, it's, you know, I often get, you know, questions to me as a recruiter, you know, can you recruit for X, how much does it cost? I'm like, well, I don't know yet, because I don't know how much work's going to go into it. I don't know how many hours it's going to take me. I don't know how, you know, have you been looking at this for 6 seconds? Have you been looking at this for 6 months? You know, if, you know, what I need to be able to understand some more information in order to provide a professional, you know, estimate on what it's going to cost and how much time it's going to be. And you're saying that just does not exist across the board for sites in completely.
Nope. So this industry relies solely on fixed contracts. If it's a 5-year oncology study, that sponsor is going to approach me in 2020 with a 5-year contract, and it's going to be a budget that sends us all the way to 2025 at the 2020 rates. There's no such thing as a fluid model in research. It's all fixed contracts.
Why do sites do this?
Maybe the question is, why does the industry do this? And the answer might be, it's because sites let it.
That's kind of where I'm going with this, because it's almost, if everyone lets it happen, it will continue to happen. You know, I know for a fact that there's tons of recruiters out there that often, you know, drop their pants and pretty much will accept any offer that a client sends their way. And if everyone did that, it messes things up for everyone. You know, sometimes you almost have to hold firm and just say, you know what, I'm not going to do it. And, you know, when I started my business, that's what I started doing. It's not that I've got FU money or anything like this. It's just, I decided that I wasn't going to do it anymore. I valued my time and my sanity more than, you know, pandering over whatever client it might be. So that's where I was wondering if that's the clinical research payment network came in to almost, are you trying to start almost a collaborative where sites get together and almost put their foot down on this?
Yes. So imagine the clinical research payment network as a third party provider option for sponsors.
Right.
So it provides a networking and community for these research sites. Mm-hmm. They can join the network. The CRPN will actually offer them financial services at very reasonable costs, because the goal is not to try to tax the sites, it's to make them successful.
Yeah.
And then as a result of earning that trust, we can figure out direct costs with those sites. And then once we have a network of sites with the agreements and the costs set in place, we will go to the sponsors and offer them access to our network.
Uh-huh.
And so as a result, so the sponsor is the patient. We are offering that patient a third party provider option so that they can access a network of healthcare providers, similar to that of insurance, and they can get the care that they need at a very expedited rate.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing to note is, if you were to go onto clinicaltrials.gov right now and you were to look and see how many industry trials were filed in 2021, I think the number is just over 400,000 trials that were registered on clinicaltrials.gov. Take that number and multiply that by the number of sites that were, of course, in each trial, and you likely have well over 4 million times at which a negotiation had to be processed for clinical research. Now, imagine if there was a third-party payer installed, and imagine if that number, the well over 4 million, could be cut by a fraction. Another interesting metric that might be useful for you as a recruiter or for anyone else is if you were to quantify the amount of time it takes to perform a single negotiation between site, CRO, and sponsor, you have well over 160 person hours as a result. An entire 1 month FTE was dedicated to processing that single negotiation.
Wow. And this happened. So, and then what would the difference be if people are part of your network and with your assistance? What's the difference there? So how much is that expedited?
Oh, well, so when the sponsor approaches the site with a trial and awards that trial, the negotiations would are to be completed for the payments, right? So we have an agreement with the sites to pay at a competitive rate so that the sponsors would no longer have to worry about negotiating when they actually needed the service. It would be taken care of ahead of time. So you would be cutting out a lot of that negotiated time.
I see. Well, look, with this in mind, I'm guessing that, it's probably quite an aggravating role at times, being in the middle of all of this chaos, really. You should have got into recruitment. We get this sort of things. But look, I mean, how's it been going? So the business started March, I believe it was, 2022. What was the single point? You've spoken to us about the drive and kind of where the mission's come from, but what was the single point that led you to actually say, you know what, there's an issue here. I think I can solve it by creating this network, speeding up payments, etc. What was the point that you said, I'm going to do it? Because I know that there's a bit of a story, I believe, around this too.
So a lot of this had to do with first that conversation with the CEO. I think that was the initial, okay, I'm going to do something about this. But the rest of it was likely between January and March, a lot of the LinkedIn monitoring. So a lot of these clinical site advocates and pretty much empowering me to say, okay, this is a problem. Someone needs to do something. I think I have a good solution for this. We can implement it like that. So from March to now, a lot of it was creating my business plans, creating the bylaws, filing, just doing the initial marketing, the initial reaching out to the sites, reaching out to the sponsors, trying to get information. But the transformation actually was almost like hole in the bucket syndrome, where I started out on a journey, on a path. I wanted to get sites what they needed when they needed it. That's how it started. And then the next step was, well, in order to do that, I'm going to have to start creating metrics to hold CROs and sponsors accountable for their actions, because it's pretty negligent right now. And there's not really much recourse that sites can do. So I started creating metrics. I invented that PACT score, a credit score for sponsors and CROs, so to speak. And then from that, I actually started thinking, well, maybe they just don't know any better. Maybe sponsors and CROs, and maybe even sites, they don't know what the appropriate practice is to work with a research site. And so as a result, I started creating the Good Clinical Business Practice training. And so it was a way of saying, well, we as an industry, we have the highest respects for informed consent, for communication. We have the highest respects for performing protocols according to promises kept or else. And so those same principles should be applied to how a sponsor and a CRO works with a site. So I created GCBP training as almost like a guidance or a standard to work with clinical sites on a business level, which would therefore be one of the variables in PACT, because it would reduce the risk of working with those sponsors. And that would result in better negotiated rates and competitive rates for sites and sponsors. So it actually rolled from, it went from a level of trying to serve the sites into creating an entire standard of accountability so we could ensure that everything is seamless, efficient, and that everyone has what they need to succeed.
Mm-hmm. And how's it all going so far? And what would you say, probably a two-part question here. So how's it going? And what are the top three things that you would list for CROs and sponsors, working with sites? What should they be doing that they're not?
Mm-hmm. So overall, At first I was very surprised. So in March when I started, I thought, okay, a free network for sites to join, it's going to be desired. I know the need is there because everyone complains about it. And it took about 3 months to get my first site to sign on. And I thought, what's going on with this? And so it's been a challenge to try to get sites to sign on. We're starting to get momentum. I'm on my fourth and my fifth one now. So the network mm-hmm. is starting to grow.
Yeah.
As far as standards and expectations for sponsors and CROs, one of the biggest things that I can say is, well, I'll just look at PACT, right? So the PACT, that says it all. So P is promises, A is access, C is choice, and T is trust. Mm-hmm. And so between all of those, you've got about 24 variables now that can create metrics designed to assess the risk of working with a site or a sponsor or a CRO.
Mm-hmm.
So overall, it's going very well. I got my swag. So I got a nice little shirt now.
Oh, you need to stick it up a little bit more in order to get it on. There we go.
There we go. I got swag. So, when you have swag, you're set, right? I'm honored to be on these wonderful podcasts. So hopefully I can talk with the industry and let them know that I'm here to serve. And most importantly is I think that we're on our way to some very successful times. The GCBP training is just about drafted. So we're going to vet it through some of the site experts in the industry. It's not just going to be the word of Dr. Fox. This is going to be CRPN as a voice, the industry as a voice. These are the guidances. I may have an opportunity to talk with the FDA. There's a possibility. I may have gotten the invite, but I haven't confirmed that one completely yet. But if things were to go very well, I really want the FDA to have a conversation with me. I was working with someone in regulatory and I asked them just straight up. I said, do you realize, or do you think the FDA realizes how non-compliant CROs and sponsors are to sites? Do they have any idea what kind of negligence this does to the quality of patient data? And the answer is no surprise. They said, honestly, I really don't think they know what's going on here. And I think that needs to change. We really, the more people that speak up, maybe the more of a magnifying glass we can put on this situation. And then maybe we can actually get some lasting change that's not simply buried by, a lot of the people who have a lot of the money.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel, if I can just come in on that. Firstly.
Yes, sir. Hi, Adam.
Hi. It's fascinating to listen to you. And I just want to say before I ask you a question, I'm so sorry for your loss. Genuinely so sorry for your loss. It sounds like there is some positive coming out of that loss and that you're focusing your attention on something positive. And what we often talk about, James and I, with many of our guests on the podcast, is really the biggest challenge is the old way, right? And what I'm hearing from you is very clearly that the old way sucks. And everyone knows it sucks. Even the FDA know it sucks. And you've identified a blind spot and given some language and some facts and some detail and data to where those blind spots exist and what they look like. And you've given it a name and you've called it out and used this drive to raise some significant awareness about that. And that is really, not just admirable, but actually, it's fascinating to hear. And I've been making so many notes as you've been talking, because it just reinforces why this shouldn't be a blind spot to me. The fact that you've even come up with your own idea around a business GCP. I love that. I think that's incredible. And it's definitely long overdue. And it's just holding people and companies accountable to the practices that have always happened, right? That's mm-hmm. That's really what I'm hearing from you. It's like just challenging that status quo and just saying that this really stinks. and it's not good. It's not good for patients. It's certainly not good for, you know, anyone involved in the process, whether you're at the sharp end of organizing those payments or negotiating them. But the metrics and the details that you provided, I think, just put that into some real perspective.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Adam. Yeah, it's the SCRS has published a number of the articles, An Industry in Crisis. There's stories of physicians who've had to put trials on their credit cards, literally, because they weren't getting paid. The biggest concern is actually that of the PIs, where I think the recent report was 70% of the PIs that do research now are what they call one and dones. In other words, it's physicians who try research and then say, yeah, this isn't for me. It's not worth my time. I can't pay my medical school bills. I just can't do it. And so I'm just going to continue with my practice. So I do, and I invite anyone out there who is interested, I want to write an article called "The PI is the Endangered Species." And that is a really big concern for research right now. We have to get our finances in order so that we can continue our track for progression of healthcare.
Interesting. And would you say
that I think also following on from that,
Adam, there was a bit of a lag there. I'll let you jump in.
I was just going to say, it sounds like this is very specific to the US healthcare system. However, I think it translates equally to different geographies across Europe, EMEA, you know, wherever you're running clinical trials. It just happens mm-hmm. that, you know, you've called it out in the US, as far as I understand.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And so, of course, being in America, I do have that bias. I have an understanding of that system much more than the rest of the world. What I can say is, as an industry, there's been an adopted process that even, you know, we in here in America are performing similar to that of the rest of the world. So if we can apply that, if we can actually just come together and say, okay, we cannot expect healthcare to speak the financial language of research. We have to turn the tables. We have to accommodate healthcare if we want to do clinical research.
Interesting. Well, look, it sounds like, as you say, look, things have started to pick up. You've got a few sites that are now signed up. They're part of the network. What would you say? Because almost when you were saying that, it's almost like you felt like that there, it may have been sooner. Now, don't get me wrong. I did exactly the same when I started business. I thought that all of my old clients would come flooding to me and I'd be a millionaire overnight. Mm-hmm. It wasn't quite like that. In fact, I went months and months and months with no business very quickly learned that, yeah, I didn't quite know everything that was going to happen. You know, it sounds as though with yourself, you were maybe expecting things perhaps a little bit sooner. But so, you know, talk us through what have been the biggest challenges so far? And you know, what's been that biggest win where you've just been like, amazing, like I feel like I'm cracking it now?
So I think that one of the biggest challenges, especially in clinical research world, is literally trying to build the trust of the sites. Mm-hmm. And the sites are inundated with so many solutions that they just don't trust new things anymore. This is a fad. This will go away. This will be just like that last E thingy that I went through. Mm-hmm. You know, my E thingy thing. But I think that the building of the trust was probably one of the biggest things that I had. And I think LinkedIn is part of it. But when I actually got people from podcast world wanting to listen to me, wanting to offer to let me speak to their audience, I think that was one of the big when James Huxley, oh my gosh, James Fowle, yes, I'm in the big leagues now.
That James check Fowle. Is in the mail, yeah. Daniel, that check is in the mail.
Oh man. So no, it's in all sincerity, I think that was the big win when people actually started to take notice. Just to put it into perspective, it took me 4 months to get my first site. Mm-hmm. And then about 3 weeks later, I had two more sign on. So it's just progressively exponential. We had to build the trust. I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to take a stand until until I'm done.
How has that been for you? Because I know for me, as I say, like I'll quite hold my hands up and say, before starting Huxley Morton, I was like doing so much business compared to, you know, any of my peers at my old employer that it was unreal. I thought that I would just be, you know, as I say, just printing money when I started my business. I went for 6 months with nothing, and I was worried about paying the mortgage and things like that. And it was tough because mentally you're like, what's going on? How was it for you on that mental side of things, thinking, holy shit, you know, what's happened? When's it going to happen? Like, how, talk us through that side of things. So I think that's something that anyone starting out is likely to go through.
Oh yeah. There's always that point where you just think to yourself, is this going to work? There's always that sense of uncertainty. Am I doing the right thing? Is this actually something that people want to do?
Yeah.
There's been all of those questions, and fortunately, I have a very good support network. My wife is just an amazing person. You know, when those founders, they're, you know, sitting there crying in the shower, wondering if what's going to happen next, you know, you've got that support network that's sitting there and willing to listen to you and just assuring you that this is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And especially, I know when you work with your wife, especially, it's always, you know, okay, well, if it doesn't work out, this is what we're going to do. We'll be fine. You know, there's really no point in worrying what you can't control. You just have to keep treading the path, and eventually things are going to happen the way that they need to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, definitely. Persistence, right? Persistence.
I think that's it. You've nailed it right there. I mean, it was the same for me. I know Adam has been an independent consultant for years, haven't you, Adam? So it's always there.
Mm-hmm. It's back to your point, Daniel, around trusting the process. We also speak a lot about, you know, atomic habits and doing the right thing, but doing it consistently, in the impact of compounding that effort. It does come back, though it can be quite a grind at the beginning of the process, and you just got to trust it, haven't you? And what you're describing and what you're explaining currently is really that return on the investment of time and effort that you put in. When people start recognizing and hearing your voice and giving you a platform like this to, you know, to spread that voice even further, you know you're doing something right. And I think I commend you on that specifically, because lots of people do give up. But I think if they've got an inner drive and an inner fire, which you clearly have, and you have your reasons for it, that, you know, that will drive you further than most people will ever experience, I would imagine.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you.
And to add to that, I mean, what is there anything that you've learned about yourself in this period? Because, again, it's all very well kind of sometimes just sucking it up and just keep going and being persistent. Mm-hmm. But again, if you just keep doing the same thing, you're going to get the same results. And sometimes you need to adapt. So it's knowing when that point is. So, you know, what have you learned about yourself over this period? And has the business plan changed at all?
Oh, yes. So, oh gosh, it's been quite the learning experience over the past 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
I am a type A personality, so I like everything just, you know, everything in line. And when things don't quite fall into your place, you have to adjust and adapt. So I've learned throughout the course of my adventures that the faster you adapt, the more successful you will become. And so as a result, we pivot. You know, the sites didn't sign up right away. We pivot to another option. We do the PAC scores. We collect the metrics. Mm-hmm. We increase our offerings. We have networking offerings. From a professional, personal point of view, I think it's more patience. It's quite literally patience. So it's really important to look back to see what you have accomplished over the past 9 months versus what you have not accomplished. See where you have come. And then you realize, well, maybe it's a good thing that I didn't quite get what I wanted right away. Maybe I didn't have the right infrastructure for it. Maybe I didn't have the right bandwidth for it. So in one really weird cliche kind of way, it's literally things happen for a reason, but then at the same time, it's a way of explaining why they're happening for that reason.
Interesting. So kind of awareness, really, just an increased level of awareness about yourself, about the business, about the industry, about the sites, you know, even the solutions and problems that you thought that you were going to be solving and providing can sometimes change ever so slightly because the market dictates it to be that way, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And I think that we have a tendency to try to learn our lessons from the past far more than we do from the present. One thing that we don't realize is what we're doing right now is literally the future past, if that makes sense. So we cannot discount what we go through right now to, you know, to be part of the lessons learned. I'd much rather learn now than to try to make a regret in what I didn't do.
I love your principle of failing fast. Many businesses that succeed at the very earliest stage do fail fast. And I think to your other point, falling forward is actually how we learn to walk, isn't it? We're falling, but we catch ourselves and we take another step. And I think that's a really important principle as well that you're describing there, which is you just don't know where that meander is going to lead, do you?
Nope. It's all about the journey. Just trust the journey.
So look, with that, I mean, what's next then? I know that I saw you recently with our good friend, Mr. Hightower, on the Note to File podcast. We've had him on here. Adam's been on the show with Brad as well. As you say, look, you're starting to get out there. You know, I've come across you so many times. I know that you're, you know, always advocating for sites. More and more people are going to be, you know, jumping on that bandwagon with you because, you know, keep doing the same thing consistently, you know, you get a bit of a crowd. So what's next? What are the plans for you moving forward? You know, is it going to be expansions? Is it more sites? Is it taking on staff? What's, you know, if you were to paint the picture for the next, you know, 18 months, couple of years, whatever.
So I just started drafting my business plan for Q1 of 2023. Well, of course, the first plan is to try to create a revenue stream. In any business, we're going to have the resources that we need to reinvest into the future. So GCBP training is going to be one of them. And then as we continue to sign on sites, we're going to have the possibilities for revenue streams, whether it be through contract negotiations or PACT score assessments, or a lot of the services that we can provide to the sites, including that the master agreements, the fee schedules that we want to generate to create a product for our sponsors. With a revenue stream, I think, and my wife will agree, that it would be wise to increase our bandwidth for services. So try to have staff to continue a lot of the marketing, a lot of the infrastructure that we need to build and develop for staffing. And then I think it's going to be an immediate balance between the development of the clinical site network and then also the marketing and reaching out to the sponsors so we can offer them that network. I think it's going to have to grow in a synergistic and balanced way.
Cool. And look, in terms of the services direct to sites, so obviously you've touched upon them, but sounds like you may well expand on that kind of offering. If you were to list them in terms of priorities as to why sites should be joining the network, what would you say are the kind of in order of priority as to why, kind of your USPs really, Daniel, as to why, you know, anyone tuning in, running a site would like to get involved?
So I would say the very first offering that we have is that of networking community. So if you as a site are frustrated because you feel like nobody's listening to you, if you feel like you're going through these challenges and you're literally alone because you have armies of lawyers fighting against your budget, if you have questions or if you wonder what needs to happen in your budget or your provisions of your contract, I think those would be some of the immediate community services that CRPN could offer. Once we get up and running, and so Adam, you might like this metric, but I've confirmed it with a number of directors, about 34% of a site's revenue is manual, meaning you have to invoice for it. So just over a third of the money that sites are entitled to has to be actively managed all of the time, which means that if you are a site right now and you are not having an active management of your contracts, you're likely missing out on over 34% of the revenue that you are entitled to. So that is kind of a segue to the other opportunity, is revenue realization and financial management. So if you need your contracts to be managed, or, you know, especially if you're on the forefront and you don't have the accounting army of staff that is there to help you to manage your contracts, that's going to be an opportunity for CRPN to help you be successful. We want to make sure that you get all of the money that's owed to you. Don't leave any on the table.
Okay.
So, and then between the networking, the risk assessment, the negotiations, and the revenue realization, I think that those could be the immediate benefits of joining CRPN right now.
Interesting. Well, I think, yeah, nobody likes the idea of leaving money on the table. So that is certainly a big one. Picks, you know, gets my ears thinking immediately. Adam, you were going to say something there with your data head on, perhaps.
It was also around revenue recognition. So I've worked for a number of big CROs in the past, and they reckon on having revenue recognition being cost neutral as a function. And if you can sell that capability, covering that, because effectively you're getting the money in that you've earned, but also as a component of that, there's also potentially out scopes and change orders and various other things around that project management and revenue recognition piece, isn't there? Which I can see that you can also quite comfortably charge for in that capacity that you're already doing that revenue recognition.
Yes. And it can be a very competitive rate, and we can essentially pay CRPN's bills, and we can make sure that our sites have what they need to succeed.
Awesome stuff. Well, it'll be interesting to see how everything goes with this, Daniel. I know that, kind of your marketing efforts are certainly up in, and you've got me signed up for part of that. I'll let you discuss that with Adam separately. He may well want to get involved, but I guess, while we're on the show, because it will probably this will probably air before everything goes live with your plans, but look, just for the audience, perhaps, do you want to share your plans as to what you are planning to put together here?
Absolutely. If you haven't checked on Facebook, my daughter Scarlett helped me create a pilot for that, and so that is actually on Facebook right now.
Share with the audience what it is first. Of course, look, so, I know, because I've been reluctantly roped in, and I'm still sitting here thinking, how have I signed up to this? But yeah,
sure. Oh, you're gonna love it. So growing up, I was a big fan of parodies, so I loved Weird Al Yankovic, and I don't know if any of you know who Bob Rivers is, but Bob Rivers created a brilliant song called The 12 Pains of Christmas a long time ago in the 90s, and so that always stuck with me. And so it essentially created what I started to write as the 12 days of research. And so I didn't sing the whole song, the whole variable, but I started at day 12, and we went from 12 to 1 and identified 12 of the most annoying things that clinical site administrators and coordinators have to go through on a daily basis just to continue this research industry. And so my hopes is, and I'm really so thankful that James is willing to help me with this, my hopes is this will raise awareness, especially to sponsors and CROs, to maybe sit in the site's shoes for just a second, just to see everything that we have to go through for our dozens of sponsors at a time, just to try to keep things going. And you can see it's kind of funny. It's funny in a way, but at the same time, it's not. This is very real. This is true from a site's experience, what we have to go through.
Definitely. Well, it will be very good fun when it comes round, Daniel. So that will be certainly one of the things in the future. But look, for now, we always like to close the show with a quick fire question round. So I'll kick us off here and just say, look, for your younger self, what would be the one piece of advice that you would give?
Be patient and don't treat your failures as failures.
Okay.
Nice.
Okay.
Or following on from that, success is often failure turned inside out. That's the one I like.
Yes.
I like to spin it with. It's a great answer. Thank you, Daniel. What is the number one book or resource that you would recommend for our audience?
You're gonna love it. I have it ready because I know that we were quick. Measure What Matters, John Doerr. Objectives and Key Results, Failing Fast is in there. The stories of LinkedIn, Google, and all of the other successful big corporate people and how they adopted their practices. very, very good, specifically with how you accept failure.
Interesting. I've not come across that one. So that's one for me to look up. Appreciate that, Daniel. And look, we often talk about kind of people building their teams, building their business. It sounds like that's going to be kind of down the line for yourself. But what would you say that the top three qualities that you value most for those around you? I know at the moment you work very closely with your wife, which is always a bonus, right? But what are the top qualities that you value most with those in your team?
Number one is honesty, hands down. If you don't keep your promises, if you can't tell the truth, just don't bother joining. Mm-hmm. Number two is flexibility. So we have to be able to pivot. We have to be able to adapt just as we do throughout life. And then number three is communication. So you can't be afraid to communicate how you feel, but most importantly, you can't be afraid to accept how other people tell, you know, what they tell you.
Awesome. Awesome stuff.
Love that. What is your favorite thing outside of work, Dan?
Family, by far. I don't know if you see up here, I've got my karate certificate. So I practice karate. I'm a black belt instructor a lot. So very good for discipline. But most importantly is I want to make sure that this goes back to my other passion for professionalism and for jobs and for job searching. James, we can talk about that another time. But I made a mistake when I was working in global pharma. And that was that I spent those 100-hour days working and I neglected my family. I didn't go to dinner. I barely saw my daughter during that time, even though she only lived for 4 years. I have my time regrets and I wish I could have taken it back. But number one is you cannot fire your family nearly as easy as your job can fire you. So if it means anything to the professionals out there who are trying to prove something, just know that you need to put your priorities where your love is.
Most definitely. Well, look, I normally close the show with kind of your people's number one golden rule, but I think you've just summed that up, Daniel. So, you know, that's it, isn't it? It's kind of like know your priorities and just, ignore everything else, really. I think Adam recommended me to a book recently. I think I already had it on the reading list, which was 4,000 Weeks, Adam, wasn't it?
I knew you were going to say that one.
4,000 Weeks, huh?
And it's all just
I love it.
Just kind of it. Look, that's
fabulous.
That's how many weeks we on average we tend to get in life.
Wow.
You know, use them wisely. You know,
it speaks to all of your points, Daniel, and really, you know, you're preaching to the choir. We're all products of having left corporate world and making our own choices based upon our own personal drives and intuition, and I think you're really amongst friends and like-minded souls, to be quite honest.
It's a good one.
I'll look it up.
Please do. Well, Daniel, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Thanks very much for giving us an overview there. I'm sure we could probably get you back in future to talk about some more gripes that sites need go through, etc. You know, I know if it's anything like the recruitment world, we could talk for days on it. For anyone looking to reach out to you, find out more about the network, what's the best way to get hold of you?
I'm a LinkedIn loudmouth, so please feel free to message me on LinkedIn. If you'd like to email me, just go to dr.fox@crpaynet.com. That's Dr. just D-R. Don't spell out the word.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Well, Daniel, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Thanks again for being part of the Huxley Morton podcast.
Oh, thank you so much, James. I look forward to seeing you again.